Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I've been looking forward to this taping all month, because we're going to be talking with Alan Gerganus about matters that range from adult secrecy to passion to the relation between privacy and fiction. And I think it's going to be very exciting because, see, people always talk about Gerganus as our living acrobat of fiction, as if Nabokov had left an heir and what was mainly to be found was prestidigitation and impressive sentences. I think that Gerganus is about taking his characters over the top and thereby taking us to places where we're uncomfortable, where we're morally uncertain, where we don't know how to field what he's throwing at us. Alan, what do you think?
I stand accused and I accept all the charges, Michael. Thank you. Yeah, I think the one of the many things that storytelling can offer is uncertainty, fascinated uncertainty. And I think that the whole concept of narrative suspense is about withholding, about withdrawing the carrot through the fiction until you're willing to do anything to find out who killed Roger. And I've tried to incorporate that into the new novellas and to build a kind of detective story suspense into each of them.
What's wonderful about these three novellas, Local Souls, is that they are built around surprises, anecdotes, misdirections, and I would say that their goal is to breathe life into received materials. So I want to focus for a while on the first novella, Fear Not, and I'm going to ask you to read. It begins, like Proust, it begins with an overture, but this time it's an overture to a musical comedy. We're going to see a high school production of Sweeney Todd. In the audience, there's a ravishingly beautiful couple and a secret about them that the narrator promises us will be unraveled by the novella's end. Let's hear a section.
Last thing, I asked Gemma for whatever name this couple shares. I say as soon as I get home, I might start maybe researching them. You could call this my invasion of their privacy, but I truly had no choice. A storyteller's first task is knowing the tale when he sees it. Easy when one's this human. Within a week, I'd Googled them silly. Beyond their stolid credit ratings, I soon gathered JPEGs from separate high school annuals, their activity photos, so precious to me now. The best info often found me by accident, fateful doublings back, birth certificates right online for all to see. Out there, in cyber blue, so much about us each just floats, resting, latent. Any stranger's keystroke resurrection can uncloud us, send us crashing back to Earth in sleek crystals and shards. How to protect ourselves? We really can't. But I swear that I, a bachelor stranger godfather, now intend to offer mostly kindness. No, better, fairness. Tracing such a union has produced this joint biography far richer than my own. Speculation is a compliment. Curiosity becomes voyeurism that once quantumed can go dignified again. This pair soon filled for me a ragged trench left behind by all my breastwork tunneling into my novel on the American Civil War. I never labored so hard. I soon found myself cross-eyed while bent before 1970s microfilm. After hours-long car trips, I descended into mildewed summer basements. Know how many southeastern county courthouses still lack central air? Their few friends proved too shy to go on record. I nosed around a Coast Guard rescue station off Maine's Black Rock coast. I flirted with the ancient lady archivist of a now-defunct charity in Newport News. I needed fuller access than she dared yield me, so I took her out to lunch and, with no expense account but my own on spec, bought her one huge Cobb salad with cowboy-worthy sirloin strips and two Bloody Marys. Then a third she said to maybe just sip. By 4 p.m. she said, okay. She'd let me see the file, though she'd first need to go home and nap. I, respectful, understood the couple could not be poked with certain questions. I had to do the work. I needed it, and now it is my fault, responsibility, and pride. I have taken in hand this pair's true documented history. Naturally, I've tried breathing real life into these local souls, apart and finally together. I'm still straining to see them through. During one overambitious high school Sweeney Todd, my simply getting to sit beside them, it was so much fun. I'd not known why. Now I do, as you will soon. I swear to God, at least 81% of the following is true.
Alan Gerganus reading from the overture of his novella, Fear Not. Now, that fascinates me, Alan. I swear to God, at least 81% of the following is true. What does that mean?
It's a sort of warning and a promise at the same time. It's slightly comic in that the specificity of 81% is much funnier than 80%. I have a friend who in North Carolina who's a great tale teller and is known to be semi-truthful. And he was confronted with this challenge and he said, listen, he said, 50% of everything I tell you is true. I just don't always know which 50% it is. And I think there is a kind of, maybe the credo for fiction writers is that we start in reality and we hope to wind up in some place that's recognizable and brand new at the same time.
Now, what immediately follows that promise, that warning, is a scene at the beach. We're seeing some beautiful gossiping children, and we're also going to see right away, I mean, this is like, what, page 6? A decapitation. And this is only going to be the beginning of an extravaganza's worth of events that will lead to our discovering this couple whose needs are answered in one another, but the answer provided after desperate circumstance. So you're guessing what makes, and there are spoilers here, I'm going to give away a secret, and of course fiction can never have enough secrets. This secret will only be the first. It conceals many others. You're answering the question of what leads a mother to take as a husband her own formerly abandoned, given up son. The ancient subject of incest. And it begins with decapitation.
Yeah, it was good enough for Sophocles, it's good enough for me. I'm fascinated with how we get to the extreme states, which always end the Greek plays. How one detail and one incident, one unforeseen circumstance at a time, we bend ourselves into feeling a certain way that drives us to something that's technically illegal, but that seems naturally inevitable. And I try in this 80-page piece to provide the reader with all the necessary information, one room full at a time, one single event at a time, that will make that reader understand and actually pull for an incestuous act at the end, and not only an incestuous single act, but a lifetime of a mother and son living as lovers. I didn't know when I began the novella exactly where it had to go, and that's part of the magic of writing, is that you're literally led as if by a dowsing rod to the true material. But I felt as I earned my way in that the inevitable end was waiting for me. And it was a fascinating act of detective work in and of itself. I'm very interested in Jim Thompson and some of the great American crime writers.
Great pulp writers.
And I've learned a lot. And I think the decapitation scene owes a certain amount to that kind of hard-boiled 40s fiction.
Now help me. I'm a reader. I'm used, say, from Garp on in John Irving's novels, to a catastrophe that will take my breath away. The death of a child. I'm ready for anything. You know, we readers have had to become two-fisted, but not by page 7 and knowing that this is only the beginning. What is it telling a reader to do?
I'm telling the reader to cast off all ropes, that you have to put your faith in me, that I have the material, I have the history, I have the narration, and if you will trust me, I will lead you to how these two beautiful people at the High School Musical came together. I will reveal to you, in seemingly documented fact after fact, the true history of this romance, this profound and technically illegal romance.
We're talking to Alan Gerganus about his new book of novellas called Local Souls, published by the wonderful reawakened publisher LiveWright. To me, I heard, fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy night, which told me that there's a diva present. And she's been given a nickname. Early on in her own high school production, she's appeared as an enunciating angel, and she has been uncertain that the microphone is working. So over and over again into her mic, she's been saying more and more loudly, "Fear not! Fear not! Fear not!" It's the title of our novella, and I think she's broadcasting to us.
Exactly. She has lost her father at the age of 14. She's been ritually impregnated by her godfather at the age of 14. Her life has been overtaken by chaos at the very outset of that life. And yet her fealty, her loyalty to this abandoned child that she's been forced to throw up to strangers centers her life and gives it a kind of focus and meaning. It's a terrible secret even to the man that she's about to marry. And I think each of us has a substitute obsession, Michael, that we can put into that position and say, oh, she loves her missing child the way I blank. I'm very interested in obsession, and I think that the novella is the perfect form to trace a single obsession.
Now, when we think about Sophocles and the sin of incest, we're pretty well told that this is a punishable act. Tragedy ends in sadness. This novella ends in extravagant joy.
That's right. Yeah, let's subvert the rules. Let's say that every love is different from every other love. Let's say that none of the rules really, really apply when you're dealing with individual human beings. When a careful kind of seeking of another person is at the center, I think we're all on that kind of quest for the one person that we think will eventually understand us, will get us, will love and accept us exactly as we are. We all consider ourselves monsters, though we've always made straight A's and have perfect attendance at Sunday school. That seems to be a cover for how we really feel about ourselves. And part of the joy of this novella, I think, is the throwing off of those false appearances and the breaking away of the artificial social conventions of small-town Southern life to get down to what really, really matters the most. And it's, for me, very powerful to see the mother who, at the age of 14 or 15, has given away her child while she's under anesthesia. She literally doesn't know whether the baby she delivered is a boy or a girl, and the institution where she's delivered the child won't even tell her that. And yet she's faithful as a kind of polar north that pulls her through her life, even to the point of learning how to use a computer in hopes that she can find some trace of this person and find him in her life. And there's something very organizing about having a passion and a central secret. And I think there's a kind of reward for those of us who think obsessively and who are true in an almost religious way to this vision. I mean, I was interested. Robert Lowell said he became a Roman Catholic when he was in his 20s and a very passionate one. And somebody asked him to explain that, and he said, well, I have a religious nature, I've decided. I think in images. How beautiful. How, you know, abstraction is invisible, but images are made to be worshipped and are worthy of veneration. And a single image of who is my baby and where is he, she in the world is enough to pull you through. It's enough to wake up to and go to sleep to.
It's a stained glass window.
It is.
The book, then, is telling us that the small town is the incubation place for secrets. And the secrets are ones we know already. The woman who's had to give up a child. The man who's secretly gay. We know all the secrets, and it's as if what you're doing is saying, okay, let's go back to that setting, and let's bring the secrets on as if they never were secrets, as if for today, starting now, the secret is parading down the street like a circus parade, and all of our acts of detection are going to be to despoil secrecy and make it possible to make public the beauty of private life lived passionately.
Marvelous. That's fantastic. What a beautiful diagnosis of my personal condition. I do think that small town life depends on the facade of secrecy, of good manners, of politesse. And behind that rest all sorts of secret insecurities and doubts and betrayals and resentments. I have friends who moved to the South, and they say, well, it's true that every clerk in every store is polite to me, but they don't mean it, so I don't really trust it. I said, give me somebody who will be superficially polite at the Walmart. I would prefer that to somebody telling me the horrible truth about my skin condition. I'm ready to have that. I think that's the makes coexistence possible in a town like this, like Falls, North Carolina, with 6,000 people. But just behind that beautiful facade is something that's much, much grander and deeper and much more humane, much more complex, and much more, for me, acceptable and inevitable, because I think we all carry with us our crimes and misdemeanors, which we're endlessly recounting and regretting. And it's a joy as an artist to be able to go directly to that material, not to withhold it, not to put it on page 150, but to put it on page 6 and 7 and let the whole thing roll.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Alan Gerganis about his new book, Local Souls, a collection of 3 novellas. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Alan Gurganus about his new book, Local Souls, a look at the revitalized American South, where sometimes everything new is really old. Now, I think that you're a great MC for something that is happening right now anyway. All of the secrets are becoming legal and public, perhaps emblemized by the fact that now it is legal for gay people to marry one another, things that had to be held back and lived as if the people we knew were grass widows or crazy loners, suspect uncles. Now we get to know who these people are, and I think that your job, the one you've taken on, is to tell us. It began with oldest living Confederate widow what? Tells all, not tells some or tells a little bit or opens the closet and peeks out. Tells all. Why is that attractive?
I grew up in a class of restraint, and of the color beige was everywhere in my house, you know, wretched good taste to the point of stultifying. And I always wanted to paint my room a very different and much brighter color. And as an artist, I was always interested in multiple forms, always interested in painting the human being. I think nothing is more beautiful and complicated and treacherous and fascinating. And I want to tell the truth. I came out as a gay man when I was 19, and it's been a huge and important part of my life. And I welcome and rejoice this advance and change. I'm also aware, because we're being complicated, of what a conservative institution marriage really is. And I feel in a way about gay marriage the way I feel about women in the military who insist on being put in the front lines so their heads can be shot off in another pointless Bush-Obama war that's meant to stimulate the American economy when nothing else is working. Wars number 1 through 4 can rage at a single time. It's hard to keep them straight. So that while one rejoices that one's friends who want to marry can, one understands that this is not a reinvented form. This is new wine in a very, very old and imperfect bottle. And I have to say, I rejoice on the one hand, and on the other hand, I feel it's a shame that all the technical innovation, all the design genius, all the imagination that's peculiar to gay people couldn't have been spent on reinventing the form itself instead of stepping into a preordained and exhausted convention.
Alan, we've only just begun.
Hell yeah, baby. Ring it on.
Well, I'm curious. In American writing, it seems to me that gay writers, Tennessee Williams, James Purdy, Alan Gurganus, William Inge, I mean, you can keep naming, have become the herald of what is happening now, that finally all of these biddy types don't have to remain living these lives of yearning and tear-filled eyes. They're some of the great characters in our fiction and drama, but everything changes. And, you know, the more you fight against the change, the more dramatic, the more operatic, the more flaming the arrival onto the real stage. Now, I think that this book has an overture, and that overture has a key signature. A high school is putting on Sweeney Todd, a musical about cannibalism. In other words, the gloves are off. Anything can enter. We're no longer pre-auditing what's appropriate material for high school students or, imagine, for their parents.
Exactly. I think as soon as the internet entered people's houses, all bets are off. And thank God for that. Thank God the universe is available to anybody with five fingers to, or one finger to poke the keys. I think as a kid who grew up in a very small town and thought he was the only gay person in the universe, that anybody who can type in the letters G-A-Y at the public library keyboard can suddenly find himself surrounded by geniuses and erotic images and numbers of helplines to call in his own town and dating services that will introduce him to somebody his own age in the same town in 15 minutes. Thank God, Michael. Thank God. How long have we waited for that? How isolated have we been? And McLuhan's Global Village is a reality. And I think that the heralds, as you say, like Tennessee Williams and Albee and Proust, we're outliers precisely because we had to fight for our sexuality. We had to define ourselves almost isometrically and to hold the door closed so we could have our pleasure and then go out and face the pain that it would cause us in the straight world. And it is a kind of prophecy. And I'm elated to be a part of that line. And I'm elated to see, I accidentally went to one of those straight websites and I saw a 70-year-old woman, friend of mine, online advertising in a sex ad. And I just thought, go girl. You are marvelous. You're looking great. I'm so proud of you. I'm so happy for you. I hope every truck driver in Virginia and South Carolina just knocking on your door. I hope you get exactly what you want tonight. And more power to her. That was not possible before. And I want to be a herald of that. I want to be a herald of desire. I want to make that available and make it clear that shame is not the only option in this life.
I've been talking with Alan Gurganus, author most recently of Local Souls, published by Live Right. Alan, that was beautiful. Thank you for joining me.
I love being with you, Michael. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Local Souls at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when James Franco is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.